All right, so one of the jobs I interviewed for in Los Angeles got given to an internal candidate, which is fine. I have a couple others I'm waiting on. But it's like, I know sometimes employers are required to post jobs even when they know it's going to be given to someone internally. So it's a little bit of a bullshit the fix is in situation. And speaking of the fix being in, please check out the song The Fix Is In from the 1990s band Heat Miser, which featured my man Elliot Smith. The song is from 1996. It's on the album Mike City Sons. Here's a little taste of that, but please check out the original. I fit the perfect picture that you want for all. And the fix is in, I'm going where I don't belong. So yeah, as you get older, you hopefully get better with dealing with life's hiccups, with the little losses, the rejections, the jobs you didn't get. I've gotten good at rolling with the punches, which kind of means you're about to be hit with a punch and you kind of roll with the impact. If you get hit with the right, you kind of shift or roll to your right to lessen the blow. I mean, best case, you avoid life's or boxing punches, but if you're going to get hit, roll with that shit. Another technique, not advised in life or boxing, is the rope-a-dope, famously and successfully performed by Muhammad Ali versus George Foreman, where Ali kind of laid on the ropes and absorbed Foreman's punches. You basically let your opponent throw everything he's got until he runs out of gas and is vulnerable. And then you turn the tables and you start kicking the other guy's ass. It does make for a dramatic fight or life, but absorbing all those punches can also take a terrific toll, as we saw eventually with Muhammad Ali. So the moral is, roll with it. Don't rope-a-dope. And I know no one wants me to start talking about boxing, but there's a rematch coming up on February 22nd with Artur Beterbiev fighting Dmitry Bivol again. Jesus, these names. The first fight was great. This one is guaranteed to be good. Speaking of the fixes in, while it was a fairly close fight, I definitely thought Bivol won the first one. A good way to judge a fight at the end is to say, okay, which fighter would I rather have been in that fight? Both fighters are great. Beterbiev has some legendary power, but Bivol is so technically skilled. I mean, watching him fight is such an elegant and masterful experience, just a truly world-class boxer. He doesn't just move around, he also fights. I kind of get the same thrill watching him, like when I used to watch Roger Federer play tennis, just kind of an artistic, beautiful display. And there's a great article by the late troubled writer David Foster Wallace about Roger Federer called Roger Federer as Religious Experience. David Foster Wallace was the celebrated writer of Infinite Jest from 1996. He had a lifelong struggle with depression and dabbled with some drugs along the way, and he stopped his depression medication, kind of an older drug called Nardil, which has a lot of dietary restrictions and stuff. Wallace had been on it for like 20 years. It had been basically effective, but after stopping it, his depression returned. He went back on the Nardil, but it didn't seem to work anymore, and he ended up hanging himself on the patio of his home in Claremont, California. He had been a teacher of creative writing at the nearby Pomona College. I mean, can you imagine having David Foster Wallace as your fucking teacher? Wow. By the way, Pomona sucks. I went there once. But yeah, rest in peace, good sir. All right, so it's time to talk about the usual stuff, swordfish, movies, music, some other crap.
You are my density. You are my density.
Okay, so I visited my mom once again recently. If I stay in Sunnyvale for long stretches of time, I do dumb shit. And while my healthy addiction or obsession has always been movies, my mom's addiction is books. I mean, she reads a shit ton. Barnes & Noble is the equivalent of a crack house for her. Whenever we go on vacation, we try to visit bookstores, The Strand in New York, Book Soup in Los Angeles, and I used to absolutely love St. Mark's Books, also in New York, but it closed like so many good places do. But she has books and books. I mean, she'll never be able to finish reading everything she wants to, but she will read until the end. It's like with me, there'll always be movies I want to watch. I have an ever-growing list, but I obviously won't be able to watch all of them, but I'll get to as many of them as I can. And my mom wears glasses, and hopefully she doesn't have the same fate as Burgess Meredith's character in the famous Twilight Zone episode, Time Enough at Last, from 1959. He plays a character whose sole obsession is books, reading books, thinking about books. He works at a bank, And one day he's hiding down in the bank vault reading. And when he emerges, he sees there's been like a nuclear explosion and he is possibly the only survivor left. He can finally read all he wants. But this being the Twilight Zone, he accidentally breaks his eyeglasses, rendering him unable to read, and his dream quickly becomes a nightmare. Speaking of nightmares, I watched a new horror movie at my mom's. It's called Bone Face from 2025. It's kind of a Friday the 13th summer camp slasher mixed with a Columbo episode. I frankly wasn't expecting much. And while it's not great, I mean, it's pretty well shot and it kept me entertained. Yes, there are major holes in the plot, but it kind of comes together with a few twists at the end. The biggest actor in the film, literally and physically, is Jeremy London. You may remember him. He has a twin, Jason London. Dude, both of these brothers have been through hell, alcohol, drugs, domestic abuse. They were kind of pretty boy actors, and Jeremy London just looks ravaged. It literally took me a while to realize that it was actually him. He plays the sheriff in a small town. There's a killer on the loose, and the gimmick is that the sheriff goes into a diner near the scene of the crime. There's a major manhunt going on, and basically one of the people in the diner is the killer. So in the old Columbo style, it's like, okay, we're going to lock the door, and nobody leaves until we figure out who did it. The movie looks pretty good. I mean, it's like maybe a 2-star, 2.5-star movie, but if you love horror movies, it is worth watching. And be ready to be shocked when you see Jeremy London in this. Like the somewhat ragged and bloated Gerard Butler, London has fallen. And speaking of aging badly, there's a couple of new AI websites where you take a picture of yourself and it guesses your age. Well, my friends, I wouldn't recommend doing this. I put a picture on 3 different websites. One said I looked 45. I was like, okay, that's not far off. One said 60. I was like, no. And one literally said I look 70. I was like, okay, fuck you. I mean, artificial intelligence can be dumb as shit sometimes, and it's creeping more and more into our everyday lives. But let's leave it to another day to eviscerate AI, why don't we? So anyway, my mom and I went to the store and got some dinner. We usually eat petrale, a pretty mild fish, but we decided to get swordfish. And later that night, kind of before we ate, I told my mom that the late Anthony Bourdain refused to eat swordfish because of how often he had seen like 3-foot-long parasitic worms that can riddle the fish's flesh. These parasitic worms can be common in saltwater fish, including cod and flounder, and these pale, skinny creatures can also be called spaghetti worms. I guess cooking will kill the worms, but it's still kind of gross. And my mom was like, "Why the fuck are you telling me this right before we're about to eat?" I mean, I can be a devious bastard at times. And plus, swordfish can be one of those fishes that can be high in mercury, which are generally fish that are like long-lived and higher on the food chain, so they accumulate a lot of mercury, like some kinds of tuna and shark. I've never come across shark at a restaurant, but I sure as hell wouldn't eat that shit. And I must bring up an incident from my youth that we would call the swordfish incident. My parents and I were eating at this nice restaurant in Sausalito. Man, what a fucking beautiful town, though expensive as hell. I ordered swordfish probably for the first time in my life. They brought it out. I took a bite and was like, this tastes kind of weird. And my parents were like, it's good, you know, keep on eating. I took a couple more bites and I was like, man, something is wrong here. So my dad took a bite and was like, oh yeah, that ain't right. It had like an ammonia taste. We sent it back and I got something else. And I was like, I'm young, but I'm not a dipshit. So I must say my history with swordfish is a bit troublesome. And the 2001 film Swordfish with Halle Berry and Hugh Jackman and John Travolta is a kind of a counter-terrorist movie. It's not great, but John Travolta's hairpiece has to be seen to be believed. And while we're on the subject of mercury, there's a great little song by this Los Angeles band, The Sugar Plastic, called Mercurochrome from their 2000 album Resin. The Sugar Plastic were just like a Los Angeles staple in that late 90s, 2000s periods. They played out all the time at clubs, the fucking Alligator Lounge, Spaceland, the Derby, and the Dragonfly. Fucking hell, the Dragonfly. What memories. But yeah, Mercurochrome is a sweet little song. Check it out. For some reason, right after my dad died in 2010, I was listening to this song a lot, so I always associate the song with my dad's death. It's a nice song, but it's, you know, bittersweet to me, to be sure. And I had mentioned before, me and my buddy Alex shot a little like 45-minute movie out at my mom's house while she was out of town. Kind of a comedy slacker thriller starring the one and only Mark D. I mean, he was the only one interested in the project. But after I cut the movie together, I contacted a few bands to see if I could use their music in the movie. I got a hold of the Sugar Plastic and they were like, yeah, but they were charging a fee. And this movie was just really a personal project. We maybe sent it to one festival. It didn't get in. And I mean, the movie turned out decent enough, but nothing really came out of it. So I told Sugar Plastic, well, thanks, but no thanks. I also got a hold of my buddy Brent from this absolutely seminal LA band from the 90s called Further. I mean, Further was just a Los Angeles staple. All the guys from the band were pretty cool, but I was closest to Brent. I actually ran into Brent at the post office on Cherokee Avenue. I used to work right by there. I saw him and was like, hey man, I love Further. And so we kind of became kind of friends after that, and he always called me Cherokee from that point on whenever he saw me. Anyway, Brent wrote a fantastic song called LHS 79, and I got a hold of him asking if I could use it in my movie. And he was like, yep, a totally cool guy. We lost touch along the way, but I hope he's doing well. But the first guy I contacted about using his music, and this tribute is long overdue, is the band Kleenex Girl Wonder, a.k.a. Graham Smith. He originally was playing out of Chicago, but he's in New York now. Just a prolific as hell songwriter, clever, poppy, catchy song, sometimes experimental, some hits, some misses. But again, just one of those guys that keeps at it, music, books, stories, whatever. He's just a creative dude, and on top of it, he's cool as hell. I was heavily into indie rock in the 90s and so on, and I was reading a lot of music magazines. I read a review of this album, Ponyoke, from 1998 by Kleenex Girl Wonder, and I was like, this sounds good. I went and bought it, and it's been a complete staple of my life since then. Just great songs, great lyrics, kind of lo-fi in the best way possible, and just genuine as hell. So Kleenex Girl Wonder was the first band I thought of when I finished my movie. I got a hold of him through email, and he was like, yeah, sure, you can use my songs. I sent him a final cut of the movie, and man, I was just so appreciative. We kind of stay in touch via email, and one time when I was visiting New York City, I hung out with him a little bit. And man, I was such an indie rock dork. I was like, oh my God, I'm hanging out with Kleenex Girl Wonder. Totally cool guy. Please check out some of his stuff. Start with Ponyoke and go from there. I used his song Wait For Me from the album Ponyoke in the end credits. Here's a little bit of that. Wait for me, there's still time. The ball and chain is rolling. I don't know what you've heard around town, but none of it is true. I promise to be back soon, and soon enough you'll see that I'll be back for you if you wait for me. Yes, I'll be back for you if you wait for me. And I always loved the song Ponyoke from the album Graham Smith is the Coolest Person Alive from 1998. Great title there. Here's some of that. I think she's a professional. She's done it all before. Driven some guy crazy and then locked her door. But maybe she'll forget about the hearts she broke at Ponyoke. And maybe she'll forget about the songs I wrote at Ponyoke, at Ponyoke. So thanks again, Kleenex Girl Wonder, a.k.a. Graham Smith, a.k.a. KGW, a true indie rock legend. Okay, in closing, I try not to get too political, but Jesus Christ, America is a bit fucked these days. I mean, our society and politics have become one big, terrible reality show. So, I mean, let's hope for the best, but America, you asked for this shit, so get ready. It seems to me like we've become so uncurious and stupid and casually cruel to each other. Everyone is looking for their 15 minutes of fame or whatever, and with their face stuck in a phone or a computer, and I, for one, think we are headed for an inevitable decline and destruction. I mean, not to get too heavy. I mean, hey, believe what you want to believe, but I don't see how any rational thinking person can look at our world today and think, yep, we're looking good. It seems like there's no truth left. It's just a bunch of demagoguery and hate. I mean, come on, man, we're better than this. Or maybe we aren't. I mean, the history of the United States has so many shameful periods. Have we ever really been that shining city on the hill? We've never really lived up to our potential, to be honest. And we're in a pretty dark period right now. But we will survive it, or we won't. But we all can still live by a certain code of ethics, no matter what else. So let's end by dropping some knowledge by a couple wise dudes. the author and Russian dissident with the longest name ever, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, author of 1973's The Gulag Archipelago. And archipelago means a group of islands. I had to look that up. He said, "Let the lie come into the world. Let it even triumph, but not through me." Man, that is good. I mean, it's like you don't have to be a vessel for the bullshit. Even if you're like the last man standing up saying this is wrong, man, there's some kind of power in that. And the historian and professor at Yale University, Timothy Snyder, whose most recent book is 2024's On Freedom, has some rules he set forth in his 2017 book On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. The first of his lessons is do not obey in advance. It's like when you see a bunch of people, powerful and otherwise, kowtowing to something that you don't believe in, you don't have to join in. In a recent article, Timothy Snyder said, "The whole point of anticipatory obedience is that, yes, a lot of people are going to do it. Don't obey in advance is always about the tension you feel because you're doing something different from everybody else. The whole point of don't obey in advance is you're going to look around and other people are going to be obeying in advance. And that's a sign of what you're not supposed to do. You have to draw your own circle." Very well said, sir. So there you go. Draw your own circle. Listen to some Kleenex Girl Wonder. And don't let the bastards get you down.